Welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show, where we talk about adventure and activism and how sports can change the world. The fastest growing segment of the skiing market is backcountry. But with more participation, we're seeing unprecedented numbers of avalanche-related incidents. For forecasters, this means greater demands on the frequency of observations, the duration of the season they're covering, and the geography they're reporting on. The opportunities for avalanche centers are bottomless. The funding, however, is not. This November, Onyx Backcountry is donating $10 of every membership to support forecasting. By leveraging their slope angle and avalanche forecast layers, you'll have access to the tools that help inform safer backcountry travel this year. Check out the link in the show notes to buy a membership and take advantage of the great tools from Onyx Backcountry today. I am super excited to have Nikki Champion on the show today. She is a Utah Avalanche Center forecaster and an ultra runner and skier and just outdoors person extraordinaire, snow scientist. And you're the second woman forecaster at the UAC, Utah Avalanche Center?
We had Evelyn Lees, who was in the Salt Lake Provo office before, and then we've got Paige up in the Logan office right now.
Oh, awesome.
Okay, there's two of us for the state.
So there's two, because Evelyn is retired now. Is that
Evelyn
correct?
Is retired, yeah.
Okay, so you are the third, or the two, there's only two women, really.
There's only two women currently at the on the forecasting staff at the UAC, yeah.
And how many men are there? It's mostly men. Do you know how many?
there's been a few, yeah, for the forecasting staff. We've got Toby up in Logan as well. We've got Mark, Trent, Greg, and Drew here at the Salt Lake office as well. Craig over the Uintas, Brett down in the Skyline, and Eric in the LaSalle's. So however many that is. And then we've got a couple women on our nonprofit side though.
Cool.
Hannah and Fran, which is great.
That's awesome.
And a couple more men on that side as well.
Yeah. So how did you get into avalanche forecasting?
Yeah. Avalanche forecasting is pretty unique because it's still like one of those careers that nobody did it the same. There's no set path. For me, I grew up alpine ski racing, really loved spending time in the mountains, went to school in Colorado for engineering. While I was there, kind of transitioned away from alpine ski racing into backcountry skiing. Took my first like Avy level one when I was 17, and then started working for the Outdoor Rec Center, helping with their entry level, like hut trips, like basically just like walk in. And that was like the extent of, there was no avalanche terrain, but started spending time with people in the backcountry. I left where I was at Colorado, transferred schools up to Bozeman, which is kind of like the mecca of snow science, and had taken my level two at that point. While I was there, I got connected with a graduate student who just needed a field assistant. Somebody to be his pit bitch, dig a bunch of holes. And I was like, that can be me. I can dig a bunch of holes. So I just went out in the field with him. We do like 5 full profile pits a day.
Wow.
Talking through it. And it's kind of there that I saw how closely related like snow science was to engineering. And, you know, building bridges didn't ever sound that exciting to me, but it was finally like a field that I was like, oh, this is something that I could apply science and be really excited about, spend time in the field and still be learning. So from there, he was the education coordinator at the Gallatin at the time. He had seen me, you know, spent a lot of time in holes. He needed an educator one day and it's kind of a pinch hitter. And got in and started teaching classes and started teaching avalanche classes in the Gallatin, started doing my own research in the Gallatin in both the earth sciences department as well as the sub-zero science and engineering lab, doing like some snow mechanics and ice physics and working as a field partner. I was working as a guide as well. I still work as a guide year round.
Oh, awesome.
In the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. So I was spending like all year shoveling and just with my head in the snow. After I finally kind of finished up my time in the Gallatin, I was lucky enough to land up at the Chugach. I got an internship with all the lovely ladies at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Spent a year there kind of working on forecasting, putting together like a publication for research and just getting a lot of mentorship. And then when the position opened up down in Salt Lake, I was lucky enough to snag it.
So you didn't live in Salt, you came from Alaska to the Utah Avalanche Center?
I did, yep.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. So you've spent a lot of time digging pits, walking around in the snow, and then what kind of guiding do you do in the off season?
I primarily do like alpine and mountaineering guiding, so big mountain guiding.
Oh, cool.
Rainier, Denali, Yeah, if there's a big hill, I will probably walk up it with you.
That's incredible. It's funny. I was like, the off season, but I feel like with the way that winter is going, it's like getting so short now that I feel like there's more of the season now that is not ski season. You know, there's more of the year.
Yeah. And we're seeing changes for that type of guiding as well. Our season is, we're pushing it earlier now, like some of that big mountain glaciated climbing. We're trying to climb earlier in the season, just to avoid, you know, like huge warm-ups like we saw last year in the Pacific Northwest. We're seeing like rock fall, ice fall,
yeah,
more untraditional weather patterns. So that season's kind of starting to shift closer to ski season.
Yeah, it's really interesting, those effects. Are you finding that it's more dangerous, or like are there other, I mean, I guess the timeline, you're moving that around. So that's good, because it can be really dangerous if you're too late in the season and you have rock fall. But are there other challenges?
Yeah, I mean, that's the main one, is our traditional timeline has to get pushed forward. We always deal with these late season overhead hazards. So weather gets hot, it rains, things like that on big mountains are never a good, you know, it's never great, because you see rock fall, you see ice fall when you see warm temps. That's why you climb at the coldest part of the day.
Yeah.
And we're seeing these warm temps earlier in the season. So we're starting to push our season. What used to be like May to October now is going to be April to the end of July. So
what's your favorite mountain to guide, and what's your favorite mountain to climb, like on a personal level?
My favorite mountain to guide is Denali.
It's incredible.
Yeah, the Alaska Range is beautiful. It's big. It feels very real. Everybody who enters the Alaska Range as a client, as a guide, no matter what, they're putting in so much work. There's not a day that you can kind of like step out and have somebody carry your sled.
Yeah.
Like no matter what, if you're there, it's real. It's big, it's humbling, it's hard.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's definitely, that one's my favorite mountain to guide. Favorite mountain to climb. That one's hard. I mean, it depends on the objective. I love it. You know, everything here in the Wasatch has been great and fun, and I feel really privileged to be here. I love Superior just because it's, you know, it's special.
Superior is special any time of the year, I think.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. That's cool. So guiding Denali, I did not know you do that. That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like how many summits have you had, and how do you take care of your body and stuff? I'm like, if you're digging all winter and guiding all summer, I'm like, that's a lot on your back.
It's a lot on my back. Yeah. I try to not carry heavy loads unless I have to. I do a lot of strength training, you know, just be ready.
Yeah.
Trail running helps a lot. I don't really do any training with weight because I do enough time with weight. You know, once you get there, and I think if you have proper strength training and then you have like your cardiovascular endurance, once you have to put those things together, it's kind of like practicing like dawn patrols. Like you just don't do it. Like if you need to wake up early, you'll wake up early. Right. But I try not to practice too much with weight just because of my joints and my body.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah.
I used to do like the Steve House, like training for the uphill athlete program, where I'd like go up and down the mountain, like 7,000 vert with like a 45-pound pack. And I haven't done anything with a heavy pack now for a while because of COVID, but we're going to Antarctica and I think we'll have pretty heavy packs and sleds. So I'm hoping that the muscle memory is there.
Yeah. And like I said, I go back with these heavy sleds and packs every year on Denali, and I definitely don't train with a sled or a pack. And you know, if you've got all those other mechanics, I think there, like the strength for the heavy weight, and you've got the cardiovascular, you know, training under your belt, I think once you have to put it all together and suffer, you're gonna be fine. Your body's gonna do it. So
okay, I'm gonna remember that.
It works for me. Hopefully, it'll work for you. I think it will.
Do you think trail running translates pretty well then?
I think so. You know, you're obviously never going at a speed like that, but I think just knowing that you can go, I do a lot of like uphill, like trail running or jogging, you know, where you like just move quickly uphill and then run flats and downhills. And
yeah, I dress like a runner and then power hike mostly.
Exactly. Yeah. Jogging.
Yes. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that's so cool that you have been on so many trips and do all the guiding too, because that's another just super male dominated field. And I mean, so looking at you, I know people can't see you, but you look like blonde, curly hair. Like, how do you get like, have you had experiences with gender bias or harassment in this work?
I've been pretty fortunate. Obviously I, especially more in guiding, I think I get a lot more blatant gender bias.
Yeah.
Because like you said, they can't see me, but when my clients show up, I don't think I'm what they expected when they're like, I hired a mountain guide. They want like a grizzly dude with a beard. They get Nikki. So I've been fortunate enough that from all my peers and the places I work, I feel super supported, especially here at the UAC. Like all of my peers are so great. And almost everybody in the professional industry as well. I kind of consider them my peers here in Utah because we work so closely with all the different entities, you know, like the patrols and the DOT, like everybody here is so supportive and I don't feel any bias being a female and actually feel pretty like uplifted coming into this new community, but guiding can be hard sometimes. You get, I think, a different type of clientele and you're not what they expect. So, and I'm not going to change the way that I guide to be that, you know. I still like having a feminine energy. I still like go to the orientations wearing a skirt. I know that I'm a strong guide. Obviously my company put me there because they believe that and they know that. And I know my certifications. So I think just like holding true to the way you guide, the presence you have. And I think that'll shine through pretty quickly. Clients know.
That is such, yeah. Your clients will know you're legit.
Yeah. They can tell pretty quick when you start going uphill and
yeah. And also just, I love that you're embracing the feminine energy because it seems to me like those characteristics of femininity can translate really well to being a great mountain guide.
Yeah. It's all communication. It's people skills, you know, the technical skills you can learn. Guiding companies, guides don't necessarily hire people for their technical skills right off the bat. That's a skill that can be acquired with training and practice, but managing high stress or like high octane situations.
Right.
Skill set that is a little bit harder to learn. So I think that's something, you know, we deal with high stress situations. There's more than just, you know, plugging some cams on like, you know, a 20-day expedition.
What is your advice for dealing with those high stress situations, especially when you have this both with guiding and in your work as a Utah Avalanche Center forecaster, where it's like people are frothing to like get their powder. They want their summit. Like they've paid a lot of money, you know, maybe in the case of Denali, and they spent a lot of time. And so how do you take that pressure in those high risk situations off to make smart decisions and keep your team safe?
You know, it's almost, you don't really take the pressure off. I think it's kind of coming into a reality check in both big mountain climbing, but here everything in, you know, skiing, it is all big mountain terrain. Often we live in a world that if you make a mistake, you get like a slap on the wrist at work. When you're traveling in the backcountry, when you're in the big mountains, if you push it and you make a mistake, it could end in death. And I think being really real with that realization is there's a lot of times that you don't get away with things and we all have people we care about. We all have things that we want to get back to. There's a lot more things that are much more important than a summit or a powder day. And I think just kind of checking back in with that is like, this is all really real. Even some days that don't, you know, even if it's your backyard, if it's terrain that you ski all the time, or if it's this huge objective, treating all terrain, all backcountry terrain, any mountain adventure with like the utmost respect. And rather than like kind of taking the pressure off, it's almost like just making sure that pressure is always there and that you're like real with yourself, that consequences are real. And just think through everything, take it slow. It'll be there. Like these mountains will always be there and you want to make sure you are as well.
That's really excellent advice. Yeah. I feel like there's definitely places in life, like you can sign up probably for a lot of like, especially like a road running race, right? And like push yourself to that absolute breaking point, because if something happens, you could just get like swooped up by a car off the road. But in the big mountains, it's not that easy, right? It's like, there's a lot of places and a lot of weather conditions where you're not going to get a rescue. Like you're responsible for your own rescue.
Yeah. And those mountains aren't going anywhere. So it'd be better to, you know, learn, you'll learn from your failures. You'll learn from your mistakes, or you'll learn from just like this year, I sat at 14,000 feet for 14 days because we had no weather that allowed us to move. And
on Denali.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't summit. We moved all of our stuff to, you know, in the upper camp. And then we sat in the same spot for 14 days, shoveling out our tent and like listening to reggae. And we didn't get a weather push and we ran out of food and the airstrips were melting out. So it's not going anywhere. And, you know, we can come back. It's a really hard decision to make, but yeah, it'll be there.
Oh, that would be so hard on Denali, though. That would be really hard. I mean, I feel like the pressure for me has changed as I've gotten older, because like It's like, I feel, I often hear this with like guides too, especially if they have kids or like they don't get that much time to do stuff. So it actually gets like more risky and the pressure gets even more intense as you get older. And I'm definitely like seeing that for myself because I just don't have as many days in the mountains where I can just be out there all day. Like I have responsibilities I have to come home to. So it's like when I do get that time, I really want to make the best of it. So.
And luckily for us, it was pretty in your face. Like, weather was bad. We weren't going to climb. So, yeah, yeah. And then we were running out of food. So, but it's definitely those on, and what people see, I think a lot more in their personal life is those hard, like balancing point, like where, you can just about push it.
Yeah. I've heard like guides day off can be a really dangerous scenario too. When you get a bunch of guides together who have a day off and like want to get rad.
Yeah. Sometimes a lot. Sometimes we also just need to do laundry.
Yeah. That's probably true. Wait, so what do you do for 14 days at camp at 14,000 feet on Denali? What else did you do to keep busy? Reggae.
Luckily, you know, we live in a time now that like most of us have like solar panels and
yeah,
like we bring electronics so we could watch movies. We do crossword puzzles, a lot of crossword puzzles. Somebody brought Uno.
Fun.
Shoveled a lot because we weren't moving. Mm-hmm. So it was snowing. So we shoveled a lot. And then it's kind of a little bit of a social scene at times. There's another RMI team there, guide service I work for. So got to see my friends. Sometimes we pop our heads out of the tent and like run across the snow and meet up and chat about our day. And you'd go see other guide teams.
That's nice.
It's a lot of time with yourself and your thoughts and, you know, journaling, thinking about things, napping, sport eating is a really
sport eating. To stay warm too. I mean, maybe it was it warm at 14K or cold? I mean,
it was pretty
cold.
Warm. It was
cold
in June.
Night, though. Yeah.
Cold at night. Yeah. Cold at night. I mean, yeah, the sun doesn't set, but colder at those hours of the day.
I mean, yeah, that must've been an experience. That's a lot of days. I'm a little bit, my partner and I are going to Antarctica really soon here, and there's a chance that we will also have a similar experience.
Yeah,
you know,
bring some movies, Netflix, yeah. Download them offline.
I've been doing like the ebooks on my iPhone instead of bringing like another ebook, instead of bringing another thing I have to charge.
And yeah, then, I do that as well.
Yeah, then you can really like read a lot of books. It takes my brain though a minute to settle into that pace of not having connectivity and internet.
Yeah, it's a very unique. It like time goes really slowly while you're in it. But then when you exit it, you're like, whoa, that went really fast because you're actually engaged in everything that you're doing. You don't have these background distractions.
It normally takes me a few days to kind of settle into like the life without that dopamine where like you're getting the bing, bing. But then once I'm in it, it's nice. So, okay. So what are some of your tips for people who want to get into backcountry skiing?
Yeah. You know, you've probably heard these ones a lot. It'll kind of like highlight the know before you go key takeaways. But I think the first three are really important. The first just being get the gear. As you start moving into the backcountry, obviously Beacon Shovel Probe, huge. When you're traveling, it's kind of the non-negotiable Beacon Shovel Probe and partner. If you're entering avalanche terrain. And I think just as you're getting into the backcountry, it's a really good practice in general. You'll see folks traveling solo, not an avalanche terrain. And that's, you know, that comes with more knowledge and being able to make sure that you can actually identify what is and is not avalanche terrain. So I think just starting off the bat, just having that Beacon and Shovel Probe and a partner every time you go out. The second one is getting the training. So once you have that gear, that's a really big step, but making sure that you know how to use it, getting the training, whether that be going to at least like a starting point would be like a 1 hour free lecture. One of the know before you go talks. There's a ton of online materials right now. Like one benefit of COVID is all these great online sources, like from discussions to online, like interactive modules, all of these things that you can just like watch from the comfort of your house. But then the next big step is obviously getting on the snow and getting a course with a professional that's going to like help you one, use your gear, identify some of that terrain I talked about, show you like why we put our shovel blades in the snow as forecasters or in the backcountry, but like getting the training. And then I think the final big one is like getting the forecast. So no matter where you are in the country or the world, there's like phenomenal avalanche centers available that are going to give you that information that you might not be able to get, say if you work a desk job and you aren't fortunate enough to be able to get into the backcountry every single day. We do that. We get into the field. We try to put all that information together and make it a digestible format. So once you are able to get in the backcountry, you don't feel like you took a bunch of days off and you're uncertain what's going on. So I think making the forecast kind of like part of your day-to-day life. Like, you know, you wake up in the morning, you check Instagram. You wake up in the morning, you should also be reading the forecast, whether or not you're planning on getting in the backcountry, because it allows you to have an idea of what's happening out there when you're not out there. So,
yeah, yeah, that's fantastic advice. Thanks for kind of going over that. I feel like it's one of the biggest questions that I get, and I'm always like a little unsure of how to answer it because I don't want to be like elitist, or do you know what I mean? Like, I want the backcountry to be more inclusive. Like, I want it to be more diverse. I want more people out there, but at the same time, like, having the gear is, and the partner and knowing how to use it, like, that stuff is non-negotiable. And I also think, like, it helps if you are wanting to go backcountry skiing to spend time also skiing at the resort if you're not like an intermediate or advanced skier, just because, like, you can encounter so many bad snow conditions.
Oh yeah, you don't learn how to ski in the backcountry.
I think it would be really hard to learn how to ski in the backcountry. At least that's like reflecting on my journey. Like, I don't know that I would have been able to learn in the backcountry.
It's not a super forgiving environment.
No.
And like we said, all those learning environments are always better when they're more forgiving. So you want to be strong with those skills before you take them into an unfamiliar environment.
Absolutely. So you talked a little bit about how COVID has brought all these online sources and interactive modules. And I was also curious, like, there's a lot of other technology that we've seen now, whether it's Avi airbags or, you know, the Wasatch Backcountry skiing app, or an app like Onyx Backcountry that has a lot more detailed information about tours. And so can you speak a little bit about how technology's kind of changed the game?
Yeah. I mean, technology's changed the game from just like the gear we're using, you know, we're all super light now, to the airbag packs, to all these planning resources now. I think, you know, it's great. It's huge for us. They're helping us move faster, move lighter, have more protection and tour plans. I think the big thing is that we make sure that we focus still on those key three, the beacon shovel probe and, the skills that go with it. So making sure that you're still always dialed with that companion rescue and that you are using those other resources to, you know, stack the odds in your favor. So making sure you're still dialed with your beacon shovel probe, you can still do a, you know, 7-minute dialed companion rescue. And then, you know, if you're wearing an airbag, if you're in terrain that it makes sense, that's just stacking the odds. That's giving maybe your partner a little bit longer. It's giving you the chance to potentially end up on top of the surface. When it goes with like the trip planning, we've always had, like, I have a topo map behind me. It definitely helps you identify things like avalanche terrain before you get out in the field, but then making sure that you still have the skills when you get out into the field to maybe in the moment correct, or if you're noticing maybe you missed a micro feature in your trip planning, like still able to have all those skills. Those basic skills, I think, need to be the foundation, and it's kind of like a pyramid. Like, everything else is going to help you, but you've got to have a strong foundation for all of those new developments to like assist and not like hinder or get lost.
Yeah. And I mean, the lighter gear and kind of the access to maps and to people's tour plans, like, I feel like those two have potentially been like a combo that can actually make us take more risks, because it's like really, it's easy to go a lot further than we ever, like, I don't know. I feel like an older woman now, because I've been in this world of like, you know, for a decade and a half, almost 2 decades. And like, I remember my first tours on my Alpine Trekkers, and I toured on those for a while. And I remember when certain couloirs were like really hard to find in the Wasatch, and they were rarely skied because we didn't have these resources, like these interactive maps that have a little blinky dot that show you where you are. So, do you see that too, that it's kind of like people's Strava tracks or like their Instagrams, their Instagram photos and videos are leading people to take more risks?
Yeah, I would assume that it opens up more risks just because there's more exposure now. Like you said, I think having all these resources, when you go somewhere new that, you know, there is no guidebook, there's no resources, it's definitely harder to get into that terrain, because the only way to really do it, or what the only way that used to be able to do it, was either like kind of mentorship.
Yeah.
To get into some of these terrain features, couloirs, to know where the skin track goes, you had to have that formal kind of mentorship. And now we have this a lot more informal mentorship, because it's like crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
I mean, that opens up a lot more terrain and opportunity two people. So you just have, you have a higher exposure. You have more people in these terrain features.
Right.
And maybe it kind of relates back to like how I talked about Denali feeling really real. And I think sometimes when it's easy to get the information, it might not feel as real. People don't realize that it is still really big terrain, even though there's a ton of resources out there. So I think, yeah, just like checking back in and making sure that even if a bunch of people are doing it and there's a skin track, it's still that big terrain, and you still have to manage it in the same risk as though you're the first person putting the skin track in or the first person putting a track down it, or yeah, just being, yeah, thoughtful in the way that we're traveling in the backcountry too, as we increase potential users or there's more people starting to travel, like there could be a party below you or above you at all time because there's more people in the backcountry.
Yeah, that's a big one. Do you have any tips for like picking partners? Because I also think that is a big one. It's like, yes, it's really important that you're dialed with like your gear and your companion rescue. But like, sometimes it can be kind of awkward to be like, hey, do you have your beacon probe? I mean, doing a beacon check at the trailhead. Like, I always try to do that. But then sometimes it can be awkward to be like, hey, show me what's in your pack. Like, yeah, make sure you have a working shovel and probe. And actually, I'm kind of shocked sometimes at like a lot of pro athletes that are like, oh, I don't need a probe. And I'm like, yeah, you do. You're real. I like, maybe you wouldn't need, like,
yeah, you can take my probe.
I need you to have a probe.
Yeah. You know, a big thing for me with my partner and partners I choose in the backcountry is people that are, one, like willing to have real conversations. And if it feels awkward to have to ask your partner, if that's something that would make them uncomfortable, like what's in your pack, like that right there, I think that maybe that's not open communication. It's high stress. It can be challenging environment and people could get caught in avalanches. So you need to be like really comfortable with each other and comfortable in uncomfortable situations. I think, you know, the necessary skill level doesn't have to like match when that comes to like avalanche training. Like I don't only ski with people who have pro twos. I ski with a wide array of partners, but what's most important to me is that they're willing to like feel comfortable speaking up. Because I think that I don't want people to have an expert halo when they ski with me and not be able to voice how they're feeling in comfort or discomfort, because that, you know, that puts everybody in a dangerous situation. I think every partner has something valuable to bring to the table. And if they're uncomfortable with the situation, I want them to speak up and feel comfortable bringing that to the table. And I think that goes, you know, across the whole board, is just being able to have open conversation on like, hey, I don't feel comfortable with this slope, or hey, I haven't really practiced my beacon. We should just do some beacon searches beforehand. Or, you know, you ask them what's in their pack and they say this and you're like, well, like, this is what I want you to carry and this is why. And it's not personal. It's just we're entering this, yeah, high stress and very real terrain. And like communication is the bottom line. And you've got to have that to make good decisions together.
Absolutely. I think last year for me, it was a really different kind of year that we've had in the Wasatch. Like last year we had a really pretty gnarly, complicated snow. I mean, it wasn't actually that complicated, like we knew where the yeah, danger was, but it was a small, you know, that small chance of a really big catastrophic avalanche. Like that can be a harder thing for us to wrap our minds around. But early in the season, my partners and I like remotely triggered a pretty massive avalanche and we were below it. And like we triggered it from super far away, but it for me was like, it was pretty scary. And it was like, hey, I need to like, it was a good reminder to kind of go back to those basics of communication. And so one of the things that I added to the kit that I always use now are like the little radios. Mm-hmm. And that's been so helpful because like a lot of times when you're traveling in avalanche terrain, if you're worried about it, you need to spread out. But then it can be super hard to communicate. And I see so often like, just we have to fight that human instinct to kind of clump together.
Yeah, I agree. Communication is huge. And yeah, traveling in avalanche terrain, I think radios, and kind of touch back on the technology part, is I think a technology feature that is helping us, because a lot of times, yeah, you get into terrain that you can't see each other, or something happens, and maybe you felt the snow and it felt different than you expected. And you can't shout that up to your partner. So I think being able to have that like active communication as the day goes on and knowing that things can change, and being willing to kind of like be flexible and change your plan.
Yeah. So I read in another interview, and this is just going back along the same lines of what we're saying, that one of the biggest challenges you have in your role as an avalanche forecaster is communication.
Yeah.
And so do you have any ideas on how we can better communicate scientific info, like snow science, what you're seeing in your pits, to influence public policy and to keep the public safe?
Yeah, I mean, the key part of our job and like why I really enjoy it is you do take these really complex problems, complex issues, and we just try to boil them down and make them digestible. You know, we're trying to get the bottom line, like the key line across to everybody. That's what our bottom line statement is. Big picture, like what we want people to do for that day. And then in our problems is where we're going to discuss maybe some things where we get a little bit more in depth, like where we're seeing the problem, how we're seeing the problem, how we would travel in the problem. And then, you know, that's where we also like include some maybe like tidbits for folks that want a little bit more scientific info. So I think the best way that I like to communicate all of these problems from, you know, snow science to climate is, you know, starting like big picture, boiling it down, making it digestible to all users. So nobody feels like alienated. We don't want like terminology that people don't understand. But then still keeping like tidbits of information that will interest like people who are already informed on the topic.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the Utah Avalanche Center has won awards. I'm not 100% sure, but you do such an amazing job as a forecasting center of like taking this big thing with snow science. And then I think Bruce Tremper he was on my show last year and he was kind of like one of the leaders with that too, where he would take it and then like make anecdotes about like the monsters in the basement or when you have a persistent weak layer underneath all the snowpack. And so using those anecdotes and like taking the jargon out. And I was reading even with climate change, like using words like mitigate can like people, they don't understand as much that word. And so making it more digestible, like more conversational. So
yeah, and we're not saying dumb it down because these are all really complex topics. We're not making them any less complex. We're just making them conversational and understandable in the way that you and I would talk to each other if, you know, we were planning on going to the backcountry tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like what information you need to know right now to keep you safe.
What other climate change impacts are you seeing, you know, in the Mountain West and in Utah?
I can't touch on climate change too much, but the big thing is we're seeing unfamiliar weather patterns.
Yeah.
And we're seeing them in a different kind of frequency than maybe we used to. So it's like hard to say which way that we're trending here in the Intermountain or in Utah and how that's going to change our snow climate. But we are starting to see these more unfamiliar, like higher precipitation weather patterns, or like dry spells for longer. You know, like last year we had the Black Rose, we had a ton of precip in a short period of time. And we'd seen that in February before, but I think we're going to start seeing more unfamiliar weather patterns. So I think maybe changing the way that we perceive the normal snow problems for Utah. I think that might become a little bit more flexible. We might start to see more years with persistent weak layers like we saw last year, like lingering persistent weak layers all season, or we might see more rain events earlier in the season or higher PI rate, like rates with really heavy snowfall, not our normal low density snowfall. So I think we're just starting to see events that we consider unfamiliar to the Intermountain West.
Yeah, I've heard that with other places too. Like I was talking to some of my friends in the Banff area in Canada, and typically that's like a continental snowpack.
Yeah.
And they were saying it's shifting, and like last year it was more of an Intermountain, and ours was more acting like a continental snowpack. So super interesting. Thanks for touching on that. So I just was quick, like one other quick question for you. So like what is a day in the life of Nikki Champion like? And I'm sure this varies seasonally, right?
Yeah, it's definitely very seasonally. You know, right now I had like kind of, we checked in this morning, told you we're like in like the prepping part of the season. So right now we're just kind of all over the place with, you know, everything from like National Avalanche Center meetings. So all the avalanche centers in the country like to get together and chat about, you know, some topics, you know, doing trainings with the National Weather Service this week. All the instructors for the UAC are getting together and having conversations. We're just kind of like ramping up to get us ready for when that snow starts, which isn't, you know, what my normal day-to-day life looks like. Once it actually starts snowing, we kind of settle into here for the Salt Lake office. I forecast 2 days a week, and then I'm in the field 3 to 4 days a week, and how that balance kind of looks is, you know, we've got 5 forecasters for Salt Lake, and our job and our field days is to go either somewhere that, you know, the other forecasters haven't been for the day, or if there's somewhere that we like got a report of like something interesting, like a layer that we weren't seeing, an avalanche, we like to go investigate. Obviously, if there's an accident, we go do an accident investigation. We learn the most from avalanches, obviously. whether it's a near miss or if it's an incident, there's a ton you can take away. So that's what our field days often look like, is getting out, covering areas that we really haven't been or need more information on. And then our forecast days are us waking up real early. For us, we get into the National Weather Service around 4 a.m. Oh. We're like really fortunate to the Salt Lake office to write from the National Weather Service normally. COVID, we'll see again. But we have those like great meteorologists right there. We get in at 4 a.m. From 4 to 5, we look over like 20 plus weather stations. We're kind of trying to see what happened overnight. The night before, we have a pretty good idea of like what we hope or could be happening overnight. But 4 to 5, you're looking at all the weather stations, the snow totals, the winds, temperatures, see if there's an inversion, things like that. At 5, we check in with most of the ski patrols and the DOT in the state, see what they're seeing, if they've got any control going on or any natural activity. And we put out that dawn patrol at 5 a.m. So for any users in the Utah or Salt Lake area, we do have a dawn patrol resource. Some people kind of forget about that, but you can call in and we kind of give you the, not the full forecast, but like what could kill you that day. So like the bottom line, so like weather, idea of what the forecast could be and if there's any closures. And then from 5 to 7, we sit down and we plug away and we're just writing our three products. So Salt Lake, Provo, and Ogden's forecast. And by 7 a.m., I'm trying to publish. I can take a deep breath. I do a quick radio interview at 8. And then for the rest of those days, I'm dealing with media or any incidents, making sure I know where all the other forecasters in the state are, checking in, and, you know, maybe taking a nap or doing some meal prep or things like that are kind of what I use my forecast days for.
Wow, that's a lot. That's awesome. That's super cool. Well, thank you so much for doing the work that you're doing and for really like leading this charge and showing, like just being a great example to women and I mean to all people of like disrupting our notion of like what an avalanche forecaster, what a guide looks like. And yeah, thank you so much for leading the charge and doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. I'm stoked we got to get on and chat about it.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I would love to come out on one of your like field days if I can tag along. I'd love to help dig and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love people who shovel.
I'd be happy to shovel. Yeah, save your back. It sounds like you have... Do you have any tips for shoveling to save your back?
Shoveling. Practice shoveling.
Yes, practice shoveling.
Rescue, it takes the most time. So doing shovel races is not a bad... You'll shovel in a snowbank just so you can feel what like set up snow actually feels like.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually try to kind of like get down on one knee and like keep my back up and use my core and like instead of bending at the waist, you know, like yeah. I try to kind of like get my body low, kind of like how a dog would be like digging a hole. You know, like I try to do that with my shovel.
Yeah, you like chop and sweep away. Don't try to throw it over your shoulder.
Chop and sweep. Yeah. Get low and like, yeah, just like, like kind of like brushing almost or paddling or something. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Nikki. It was awesome to connect. I really appreciate all your time. And I would love to get out in the mountains with you. So let's yeah, make that happen. Okay. Awesome. Have a great day.
I am resilient. I trust the movement. I negate the chaos. Uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again and again. I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks to Avery Sandak for his help with the audio on today's episode. To my partner, Rob Lee, for being extra quiet while recording in the house today. And to Rising Appalachia for graciously providing the music for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate and review it so other people can find it. Until next time.